Hello there, and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. We are starting a brand new series in the book of Jeremiah, which very few people know is the longest book of the Bible from a word count perspective. And today we're starting with a teaching entitled The Prophecy of Jeremiah. For the entire month of September, we are going to be in the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah is the 24th book of the Bible, and it is the second book within the prophets. Now, I say the prophets because there are 16 books of the Bible that are known as the prophets. And when you consider that the Bible has 66 books in total, 16 books dedicated to one genre or one group is quite significant. And when you look at the fact that there are 16 prophets throughout the Bible, the question we have to ask is why? Why do we have so many prophets in Scripture? And if you can answer that question, then you can ultimately answer the second question, which is, why should we study the prophets today? Most Christians I know would respond to this question of why do we have the prophets and why should we study them with an answer that is similar to this. The prophets predicted and foretold the life of Jesus, the Son of God. In other words, Christians look back through history, they look at the prophets, they look at this life that would come about 500 years later in the form of Jesus Christ, a man who they proclaim to be fully human and fully divine, and say that that life, that incarnation, that person and that being was no accident. It was predicted, it was planned, it was foretold by these prophets, and the people that were living at the same time as Jesus should have known better because the prophets told them to be on the lookout for the Son of God. So with that understanding, we should be able to turn to Jeremiah and see page after page after page of Jeremiah predicting a life that would exist about 500 years after Jeremiah lived. And so let's do that, shall we? Let's go through every verse where Jeremiah predicts a Messiah, where Christians point to Jeremiah and say, see, he's talking about the life to come, which is Jesus Christ. And if you scour through all of Jeremiah, you come across four verses in total that speak of a Messiah or speak of a life that is predicted. These four verses are found in Jeremiah 23, verses 5 and 6, and Jeremiah 33, 15 and 16. Let's read through those two passages, shall we? Jeremiah 23, 5 and 6 reads this, "The days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will live in safety. And this is the name by which he will be called. The Lord is our righteousness." The second passage that Christians say predict the life of Jesus is Jeremiah 33, 15 to 16, which reads this way, "In those days and at that time, I will cause a righteous branch to spring up for David, and he shall execute justice and righteousness in the land." Does this sound familiar? It should, because it's almost identical to the previous passage we just read. Verse 16 goes on in the same way. It says, "In those days, Judah will be saved and Jerusalem will live in safety. And this is the name by which it will be called. The Lord is our righteousness." Now, it's important for us to acknowledge what Jeremiah's bold prophecy is. Because a lot of Christians, when they hear about the prophets, they say, well, they called it. They called the life of Jesus in a very specific way. They say he'd be born in Bethlehem in a manger, and they go on and on and on about specific things. Jeremiah's prophecies, though, in particular, are not that specific. All Jeremiah predicts is that in the future, someone who is a descendant of David will execute justice and righteousness. Notice for a moment how wide that prophecy is. This is not very specific. It's more a statement of hope than a bold prediction. Now, at this point, you may say to me, Craig, look, I know the Bible really well. And in Matthew 27, Matthew says that Jeremiah predicts more than that. And if we read Matthew 27, verse 9, it reads like this. "Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one on whom a price had been set, and on whom some of the people of Israel had set a price." So Matthew says these 30 pieces of silver that Jesus was sold for was called by Jeremiah so long ago, which is a great specific prediction and prophecy, right? There's just one problem. Jeremiah never said that. If you read through all of Jeremiah, he never predicts this. But someone else does. And that is the prophet Zechariah. And Matthew misses his citation here and attributes a quote that Zechariah said to Jeremiah. And the fact is, Jeremiah didn't have a whole lot to say about a prediction of a life in the future. Jeremiah didn't talk about Messiah that much. In fact, if you look at all the book of Jeremiah, there are four verses in the book of Jeremiah that predict a Messiah. There are 1,364 verses in total in the book of Jeremiah, which means that 99.7% of the time, Jeremiah is not talking about a Messiah. So when people say things like the prophets were there to predict and foretell the life of Christ, and they lump Jeremiah into this category, it's similar to someone going to see the movie Star Wars, A New Hope, and someone asking that person, what was the movie about? And they respond by saying, sand. Now, sand is in Star Wars, A New Hope, but I wouldn't say that's what it's about. And so when we talk about these prophets, and in particular Jeremiah, and people ask the question, why? It's important for all of us to stop answering that question by saying the prophets predict and foretell the life of Jesus, the Son of God. We show our ignorance and our inability to actually sit down and read whenever we answer that question this way. Jeremiah had very little to do or very little interest in predicting the life of a Messiah, which leads to a necessary question. What is a prophet? Now, to figure out what a prophet is, I think that we should read the prophet Jeremiah. But before we start with chapter 1, verse 1, we should talk a little bit about the context of Jeremiah. Now, what I love about the people of Paradox is that this is a group of people that loves the historical context when we talk about Scripture. In other words, we are a gathering of nerds who geek out on things like, what were some other things going on when Jeremiah was writing these things? I love you guys. Thank you for caring about the historical context around Scripture. So to understand the historical context of Scripture, we have to go back to the beginning of Israel's history. Let's go back to Israel's first king, a man named Saul, who united the 12 tribes and was the first king of the kingdom of Israel. He was then violently overthrown by a man named David, who many consider to be Israel's greatest king, which I do not consider him to be, but that's another sermon for another time. And then David had a son named Solomon, who took the kingdom of Israel to its highest power, its highest amount of wealth. He did this all at the expense of his own people, though, and people hated him as a king. They hated him so much, in fact, that when Solomon died, the elders of the kingdom of Israel went to his son Rehoboam, the heir apparent, and said, please be a kinder king than your father. Rehoboam heard these concerns and responded by holding out his pinky and saying, my little finger is bigger than my daddy's genitals. Perhaps the most epic and horrible line in all of the Old Testament. His words are so repugnant and offensive that it actually splits the nation in two, and there is the kingdom of Israel to the north and the kingdom of Judah to the south. The kingdom of Israel to the north is ruled by a man named Jeroboam, and the kingdom of Judah, which is where Jerusalem is reigned by David's grandson, a man named Rehoboam, who did the finger thing. So as the centuries go by, the north has a lot of tumultuous, violent overthrows. The South has a lot of uncertainty because they're poorer than the North, but they at least have a Davidic ancestor on the throne at all times. This all comes to a head, though, in 722 BCE when the Assyrian Empire comes into the North and conquers Israel. Because the southern kingdom of Judah, which is where Jerusalem is, was friendly to the Assyrians, Assyria did not destroy them. But in 722 BCE, 10 of the tribes of the kingdom of Israel were then wiped out and were no more. So with that in mind, let's open Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 1 and read what the prophet has to say. He writes, "The words of Jeremiah, son of Hilkiah, of the priests who were in Anathoth in the land of Benjamin, to whom the word of the Lord came in the days of King Josiah, son of Ammon of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign." This may sound boring, but Jeremiah is establishing the date when he began to write. He begins to write in the 13th year of King Josiah's reign. He's giving us the date when he began to speak, and Josiah is Judah's fifth to last king. He continues in verse 3, "It came also in the days of King Jehoiakim, son of Josiah of Judah, and until the end of the 11th year of King Zedekiah, son of Josiah of Judah, until the captivity of Jerusalem in the fifth month." So the captivity he is referring to is the conquest of the Babylonian Empire when they destroy Judah and force people of Judah to live in Babylon as Babylonians. This happens in 586 BCE and is documented by extra-biblical sources, so we can be certain about that date. But what Jeremiah is saying is he's saying, from the fifth to last king onwards, I was a prophet in Judah during this time. When Jeremiah speaks, he is speaking at a very uncertain time within Judah's history. Which brings us back to the question, what is a prophet? Well, I would start by saying that a prophet is a real human being dealing with real human issues at real human times. Jeremiah is concerned first and foremost with 6th century BCE Palestine and what Judah can do in the face of oppression, in the face of fear, in the face of being conquered. And Jeremiah writes to the nation of Judah about what they can do with their backs against the wall. So we must remember that Jeremiah is first and foremost a human being. And when he says he's a prophet, he's not denying his own humanity. Which leads to a really interesting story in Jeremiah chapter 7. This will be our main story for this podcast. We read these words, "The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, stand in the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word and say, hear the word of the Lord, all you people of Judah, you that enter these gates to worship the Lord." Now this is significant because Jeremiah is asked by God to go to the religious epicenter of Judah, the house of the Lord, the temple that Solomon built about 500 years ago. Now, this is an opulent and magnificent temple. To give you an idea of how opulent it is, the entire interior is laid with the cedar of Lebanon. That cedar of Lebanon was then painted over with gold, and from floor to ceiling, the entire interior is covered in gold. So God asks Jeremiah to go to this temple and say these words that we read in verse 3. He is to say, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and let me, being God, dwell with you in this place." Now, this is a very strange thing for someone to say next to the temple, because the temple was composed of two rooms, the holy place and the most holy place. Now, most priests were allowed to go into the holy place, which was the outer chamber, but only the high priest was allowed to enter the most holy place once a year on the Day of Atonement. In the most holy place was the Ark of the Covenant, which is where the people of Judah believed that God sat. So if you were living 2,500 years ago in Judah, and you were to ask someone living in Judah, "Where is God?" they would not respond to you by saying, "God is everywhere." They would point at the temple and say, "God is in there. God lives with us. God is here among us." And the temple was the living incarnation that God was among God's own people. So God asked Jeremiah to go to this place where God supposedly lives and say these words, "God doesn't live here. Change how you are doing, change what you are doing, and God will begin to live here again." And that's the message that God gives Jeremiah. This is a scandalous prophecy that is given to the prophet Jeremiah. He then goes on to say in verse 4, "Do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord. This is the temple of the Lord. This is the temple of the Lord." He says it three times in a row to emphasize his point, which was very important within ancient Jewish culture and is also very important within parenting culture today. We have to say things three times in a row in order to get our point across. So Jeremiah is at the temple gate where people believe that God lived, and he's saying this isn't the temple of God. God doesn't live here. We have to change how we behave in order for God to live with us. Now here's where the prophecy becomes very interesting. In verses 5-7, Jeremiah says to anyone who will listen to him while he stands at the gate of the temple these words. He says, "For if you truly amend your ways and your doings, if you truly act justly with one with another, if you do not oppress the immigrant, the orphan, and the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own hurt, then God will dwell with us in this place, in the land that God gave of old to our ancestors forever and ever." Jeremiah says, we were called to be a nation who looked after people who immigrated into our nation. We were called to be a nation who took care of the orphan who are without parents. We are called to be a nation who care for the widow. We are called to be a nation who does not shed innocent blood and who does not persecute other religions. And yet we have become that very thing that we were told we should not be. Let's change it, and then God can live among us again. What Jeremiah is getting at is this idea that God called the nation of Judah to care for people who are in need. But somewhere along the way, Judah became more obsessed with building opulent temples. Judah became more obsessed with building a powerful military. And the nation of Judah lost its ways. Jeremiah does not stop there. He goes on to chapter 8, 9, 10. He keeps saying things like this all the way until Jeremiah chapter 20. And we presume that he is at the temple gates this entire time with a few breaks. And when he is done saying all of these things and doing metaphors where he smashes pots and digs up underwear and all sorts of weird other things, we finally hear the official religious response from the high priest who works at the temple in Jeremiah chapter 20. Now remember, the high priest who works at the temple has a paycheck from people who believe that God lives in this building. His whole responsibility is to speak on behalf of the people to God. And along comes this schmo from the tribe of Benjamin, a man named Jeremiah, standing at the gate and threatening the entire thing by saying God doesn't actually live here. So Jeremiah 21, we hear from the high priest. We read, "Now the priest Pashur, son of Immer, who was chief officer in the house of the Lord, heard Jeremiah prophesying these things." How do you think Pashur responded to Jeremiah? We find out in the very next verse, Jeremiah 22, when we read, "Then Pashur struck the prophet Jeremiah and put him in the stocks that were in the upper Benjamin gate of the house of the Lord." And Jeremiah, who was convinced that God asked him to give a message, is placed in stocks to humiliate him by the religious institution. Jeremiah is in stocks. He is laughed at. He is spat upon. He is rejected. And after some time, he is released from the stocks, and he shares his feelings in the next several verses. Jeremiah 27 is the prophet saying these words, "O Lord, you have enticed me and I was enticed. You have overpowered me and you have prevailed. I have become a laughingstock all day long. Everyone mocks me. For whenever I speak, I must cry out. I must shout violence and destruction. For the word of the Lord has become for me a reproach and derision all day long. If I say I will not mention him or speak any more in his name, then within me there is something like a burning fire shut up in my bones. I am weary with holding it in, and I cannot. In other words, Jeremiah sees widows and orphans and immigrants being steamrolled by the rich and powerful. And he feels like he has to say something. And when he doesn't say something, he cannot hold it in because there is, quotes, a fire burning in his bones. He has to say something. And it's here, while Jeremiah is in stocks, that we have to ask the question, what is a prophet? Because we often think of a prophet as someone who has it all figured out, who is being spoken to and directed by God, and therefore knows exactly what the next move is, and all they have to do is just simply walk through. But here is Jeremiah expressing severe doubt, severe uncertainty, severe remorse for the fact that he has spoken up, even though he spoke up for the right thing. What is a prophet? Perhaps Rachel Held Evans defines it best in her book Inspired when she says, perhaps the most significant character in any story of resistance is the prophet. Biblically speaking, a prophet isn't a fortune teller or soothsayer who predicts the future, but rather a prophet is a truth teller who sees things as they really are, past, present, and future, and who challenges their community to both accept that reality and imagine a better one. What is a prophet? I believe a prophet calls attention to pain that we'd prefer to avoid and asks us to do something about it. Jeremiah tried his best to call attention to those who were poor or marginalized by society in Judah, and the religious institution put him in stocks for doing it. He pointed to their pain. He empathized with them. And yet no one wanted to hear about it. A prophet calls attention to pain we'd prefer to avoid and asks us to do something about it. And when you look at that definition of what a prophet is, it's not long before you recognize that prophets live among us today. Nearly 30 years ago, all the way back in 1990, an Irish singer-songwriter named Sinead O'Connor covered a Prince song. The song she covered, very few people knew before 1990, and that song was Nothing Compares to You. When Sinead O'Connor covered it, though, there was something about the spirit and the soul and the emotion that she played in the recording that connected with a large group of people very quickly. Her cover of Nothing Compares to You shot to number one on the worldwide Billboard charts around the world and stayed there for 4 weeks. Not only that, but in 1991, just the very next year, she won 3 MTV Video Music Awards, back when those things really, really mattered. In that same year, she was nominated for 4 Grammys, but she started to realize that she had a platform. And she said that she would not be attending and she would reject any Grammy that was given to her because Grammys promoted the commercialization of music rather than the art. Despite that protest, she still won 1 of those 4 Grammys. In 1991, she was also named the Rolling Stone Artist of the Year. And in the early 1990s, there was no one on top of the musical world as much as Sinead O'Connor. Well, another year went by and she released a new album, and in 1992, because she was on top of the musical world, she was invited to be the guest musical artist at Saturday Night Live, one of the biggest platforms because back then we had like 4 channels and that was it. Guest artists at Saturday Night Live performed 2 songs, and so the first song, Sinead O'Connor performed something off her album. But for her second song, she said, I want to cover a song by Bob Marley called War. And that song is a song that needs to be a cappella. So on live TV on October 3, 1992, Sinead O'Connor sang a 3-minute a cappella song. And I'd like to play for you the last few seconds of that song from that evening.
We have confidence in the victory of good. over evil. Fight the real enemy.
Now, what you can't see unless you watch the video is that right on that last line, Sinead O'Connor held up a picture of the Pope, and that ripping sound that you heard on the audio recording just a few moments ago was her ripping up a picture of the Pope on live TV. Yeah. There was stunned silence in the audience shortly after that. No one knew how to react. And because this was all the way back in 1992, there was no Twitter where Sinead O'Connor could then go on and explain her actions. All that we know is that she made some people very angry by ripping up that picture. Over the next couple of days, NBC would receive 4,000 phone calls that were complaining about Sinead O'Connor's actions. 1 week later, Saturday Night Live went to its next episode, and it was hosted by Joe Pesci. He of Home Alone fame. He began his monologue by saying these words: "There was an incident on this show last week. Sinead O'Connor tore up a picture of the Pope, and I thought that was wrong. So I asked somebody to paste it back together." He then grabbed a picture of the Pope that was pasted back together. There was raucous applause at Saturday Night Live. He then went on to say, "I think that's a lot better. Case closed." After another beat, he said, "Why should I let it bother me? It wasn't my show, it was Tim Robbins' show. But I'll tell you one thing, Sinead O'Connor was very lucky it wasn't my show, because if it was my show, I would have gave her such a smack." To which there was immediate laughter and applause. He then said, "I would have grabbed her by her eyebrows." More laughter, more applause. And then he said, "I'm making myself crazy for what?" So Joe Pesci was so offended by Sinead O'Connor's actions that he threatened domestic violence against her. About 2 weeks after Sinead O'Connor tore up the picture, there was a Bob Dylan tribute concert happening in Madison Square Garden. This concert quickly sold out because it was headlined by the biggest and boldest names in all of the music industry, including Sinead O'Connor. Now remember, this is in New York where they film Saturday Night Live. And so in Madison Square Garden, when they invited Sinead O'Connor out onto the stage, when her name was announced, there was an immediate overpowering chorus of boos that rained down from all of the garden. They booed so much, in fact, that they delayed the start of Sinead O'Connor's cover of a Bob Dylan song. After a long time waiting for the boos to subside, Sinead O'Connor made a motion to the piano player to start the song. But the boos overpower the piano. Sinead O'Connor then quickly cut off the piano player, waited another minute as the boos continued to come down, and then tried to start the song again, but once again, the boos won out. She then said, "Turn my mic up." And she began to sing the Bob Marley song that she sang on Saturday Night Live. And after it was done, she walked off the stage. She began to cry. And it's here that music historians point to the career of Sinead O'Connor and say it was over at that moment. A few days later, on October 24, 1992, 3 weeks after tearing up the picture of the Pope, Sinead O'Connor wrote an open letter to media sources, which was published by several newspapers, including the Los Angeles Times. In this letter, she said these words: "My name is Sinead O'Connor. I am an Irish woman, and I am an abused child. The only reason I ever opened my mouth to sing was so that I could tell my story and have it heard. If the truth remains hidden, that the brutality under which I grew up will continue for thousands of Irish children. And I must, by any means necessary, without the use of violence, prevent that happening because I am a Christian." And Sinead O'Connor reveals that she is an abused child, and she is asking people to do something about the abuse, the systemic abuse of children that happens throughout all of Ireland. That very same night, on October 24, 1992, Saturday Night Live had another episode where they mocked Sinead O'Connor relentlessly with a skit called "It's the Sinead O'Connor Good Time Happy Jamboree," where people booed her and she weeps in front of them and people cheer. 2 days after this, on October 26th, Lorne Michaels, the longtime producer of Saturday Night Live, sat down with Charlie Rose to be interviewed about the incident with Sinead O'Connor. Lorne Michaels talked about it with these words. He said, "There were a lot of phone calls, and it seemed, I think people understood, that the show hadn't advocated tearing up the picture. It wasn't that people agreed or disagreed with her politics. It just seemed so incredibly inappropriate. The tragic part was having to do the two comedy acts after that. Al Franken had a Stuart Smalley piece. I know he got hurt by this action a little." 1 month later, in November of 1992, because this is how news stories developed back then, Sinead O'Connor sat down to be interviewed by Time magazine. In that interview, she said these words, "Look, it's not the man, the Pope, obviously. It's the office and the symbol of the organization that he represents. In Ireland, we see our people are manifesting the highest incidents in Europe of child abuse. This is a direct result of the fact that they're not in contact with their history as Irish people, and the fact that in the schools, the priests have been beating the crap out of the children for years and sexually abusing them." Now at this, the interviewer is stunned. Here is a folk singer saying the Catholic Church is molesting and abusing children. This is something this interviewer has not heard before, so he asks a clarifying question, to which she responds by saying, "Look, I went to schools every day covered in bruises, boils, styes, and face welts. You name it. Nobody ever said a bloody word or did a thing." This was all back in 1992. 10 years later, the Boston Globe published a story on January 6th in 2002 entitled "Church Allowed Abuse by Priest for Years," and this story was researched by the Boston Globe Spotlight team. It was in this story that the Boston Globe discovered that the Catholic Church had several priests in the Boston area who had raped or attacked multiple victims, and the church knew about it, and rather than confronting their priests about it, rather than coming out and saying, "We have a problem," they would shuffle the priests around, allowing and enabling them to have more victims at different locations. This was a major story, and it shocked the United States of America. It was such an important story that it became the subject of a film called Spotlight, which won Best Picture in 2015. 8 years after that story was written, 18 years after Sinead O'Connor tore up the picture of the Pope, Pope Benedict writes a formal letter of apology to Irish Catholics for the systemic abuse that has happened over the past several decades. In this letter, he said these words, "To the victims of abuse and their families, you have suffered grievously, and I am truly sorry." And Pope Benedict acknowledged that this systemic abuse happened over and over again, and he apologizes for it. The thing that Sinead O'Connor protested 18 years before this letter was acknowledged and accepted by the Catholic Church. A few days after this letter came out, the Washington Post invited Sinead O'Connor to come back and write their op-ed for their newspaper. In this op-ed, she said, "The Pope's letter states that the church in Ireland must first acknowledge before the Lord and before others the serious sins committed against defenseless children." She then asks the question that should have been answered in Pope Benedict's letter. What about the Vatican's complicity in those sins? The sexual and physical abuse is disgusting beyond words. But what made those actions even more disgusting was that the church knew about it and protected the perpetrator rather than the survivor. The church was more concerned with protecting its reputation than standing up for people who were in need. Sinead O'Connor then talks about that event that happened 18 years ago on Saturday Night Live. She said, "I knew my action would cause trouble, but I wanted to force a conversation where there was a need for one. That is part of being an artist. All I regretted," she says, "was that people assumed that I didn't believe in God. That's not the case at all. I'm Catholic by birth and culture and would be the first at the church door if the Vatican offered sincere reconciliation. 20 years later, all the way in 2012, people are still talking about what Sinead O'Connor did on national live television. And The Atlantic, a major news publication that is not Christian or spiritual, as far as I can tell, ran an article called The Redemption of Sinead O'Connor on October 3, 2012, the 20th anniversary of her tearing up the picture of the Pope. In there, the author, Michael Agresta, used these words. He said, "If we in the American entertainment media couldn't see O'Connor for the prophet she was, we were off the mark in blaming the messenger. We could have done a much better job of listening to what she had to say." He's right, isn't he? Because when Sinead O'Connor tore up that picture, I was 9 years old. But I can guarantee you that if I was 18 or 24 or 28, I would have been furious with her. I would have viewed her action as disrespectful. I would not have wanted to hear a conversation about child abuse by a church entity. And it's here that the author of this article, Michael Agresta, uses a word to describe Sinead O'Connor's action. She is a prophet, which is fascinating because when I look at the story of Sinead O'Connor, it feels and moves and acts exactly like the story of Jeremiah. They both saw people suffering, including themselves, and decided to say something about it, confront people about it. And people responded by saying, you know, not now. Is this really an appropriate time to talk about this? And yet when I read her words, Sinead O'Connor says, "I was trying to force a conversation about sexual child abuse." Why? Because it's got to stop sometime. When we ask the question, what is a prophet? A prophet calls attention to pain we'd prefer to avoid, like child abuse, and asks us to do something about it. Prophets live among us today, which raises the question, how am I prepared to hear what the prophets have to say? That's a real tough and yet vital question that we must ask ourselves. How am I prepared to hear what the prophets have to say? So much of our spiritual maturity is preparing our mind to hear things that are difficult to hear, to pay attention to pain we'd prefer to avoid. And yet when someone comes along and brings our attention to that pain, do we look the other way? Do we plug our ears? Do we close our eyes? Do we distract ourselves with things that are trivial? The question we must ask ourselves is, how am I prepared to hear what the prophets have to say? And the other part of the story is what happens when we see pain and no one is speaking on that pain's behalf. Because what Jeremiah did was he saw an injustice and he decided to do something about it. And yes, they put him in stocks. Yes, they ridiculed him. Yes, they rejected Jeremiah. But when we look at Jeremiah's writings, you know what we call it today? We call his writings holy. And this story of a man confronting injustice is, in fact, holy. When I look at the work of Sinead O'Connor and what she sacrificed in order to confront an injustice, I have to use the word holy. Because confronting injustices is holy. That's the work that we are called to do. That is the people that God created us to be. And it is our responsibility to speak up and call attention to pain that society would prefer to avoid. My brothers and sisters, may we have the ears to hear what the prophets have to say. And may we have the voice of the prophets to speak up on behalf of the voiceless. May you see and embrace Jesus Christ in all.